From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we are recording in front of an audience in Wauwatosa. It is Lake Effect on site from Birch on North Avenue in East Tosa.
We'll be joined by Tosa Mayor Kathy Eli, who will give us her view of where the city was and where it's going. Plus, the Journal Sentinel's Tom Dakin stops by to discuss development here.
Later, we'll learn about the Ward Irish Music Archives, which are located just down the street.
We'll talk about heritage pork and beef with the folks from Kettle Range Meats.
Plus, some organ-fueled grooves of doom from tonight's house band, Tosa's own Cock Marshall Trio.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We are in Wauwatosa today for our Lake Effect on-site series. We are recording in front of a studio audience at Birch, located right behind Camp Bar on North Avenue in East Tosa.
The North Avenue corridor is seeing a renaissance these days. A decade ago, many of these storefronts were either empty or overlooked. Today, there are restaurants, shops, yoga studios, and even pocket parks all along North Avenue.
Some of this has happened in the years since Kathy Eli became mayor in 2012 after serving as executive director of Wauwatosa Village's Business Improvement District. She's currently in her second term, and she joins us right here at Birch. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and we're so grateful you're in Wauwatosa.
Mayor, we're sitting on a street that has really transformed. What do you think's made it possible?
Well, it took a lot of hard work. There's a lot, and there's some people in this audience who put a lot of hard work into that revitalization, and I want to, Meg Miller is here tonight. I saw her when I walked in. She was one of the residents in the area. This is really, this initiative was a resident-driven initiative.
As the mayor, how do you weigh creating the climate that makes this possible with the other needs of the community, making these thriving businesses, but also weighing the livability of a place for the people that live, you know, 50 or 100 feet on either side of North Avenue?
Well, I don't know that we've made it perfect, but a situation like this always comes forward, trying to find balance. And I've lived in Wauwatosa for 40 years. In fact, my first duplex is right north or south of North Avenue on 65th. And so I saw this area and how many times a number of us tried to revitalize it. But it really took the revitalization of the live local concept. And I think that's what helped turn it around. And of course, a number of the properties changed hands. And you get new owners in, there's new energy, a new excitement, and they really helped carry that along.
Well, this is very much an urban-suburban community. I mean, Milwaukee's not very far away. What are the unique challenges here?
Well, it actually, you know, other than the street signs changing, the types of homes, it blends very much. So it's exciting. I'm very much a regional believer, and we need to not worry so much about city municipal boundaries, but really support each other whenever we can. And so I think that's what's happening along Wauwatosa. So when one area gets stronger, it spreads and it helps adjoining areas get stronger. When the village got stronger and people wanted to move to Wauwatosa and open businesses, it was the time when North Avenue was ripe for that redevelopment. So it's exciting to see what's going on.
You're talking about believing regionally. Are there cautionary tales? I mean, Wauwatosa is a community like a number of other kind of inner ring suburbs, and many of them have kind of revitalized and fits and starts. Have you found cautionary tales from the experiences of other communities around the region?
Well, I think the thing that's unique about Wauwatosa is we were a city before. We did not build as a bedroom community of the city of Milwaukee. So we have that history. The village area was our original downtown. And so it's authentic. And we find that a lot of other communities are trying to create what we have here. And so I think that we have a stronger base in keeping this going.
One of the things you said, you just come from speaking about regional transportation.
Yes.
And that is of course, a key part of development. It's so important for people to be able to get to businesses,
right,
to whether they're working or shopping. And so do you see that changing over time? Are people embracing more on a policy level mass transportation?
I see a hint of it. I've been part of the Regional Transit Leadership Council for 5 years now. I was one of the founding members. We pulled in some leaders, business and elected leaders from Waukesha County, and we're working on getting other counties involved. And we find now that more people are paying attention to it because it's an economic issue. We have to work to get, we have to figure out how to get workers to their jobs. So that's very positive, and Wisconsin desperately is behind. I mean, we desperately need to provide more multimodal options for people to draw people to moving to our state as well.
Can you think back to, you know, 6+ years ago when you took office and do a little compare and contrast the kinds of issues that were on your radar and that you were dealing with as you took office versus the kind of stuff that is on your plate today?
Well, North Avenue certainly was not what it is today. The village was in a big transformation. We were one of the communities that was early in the reinvestment time after the recession, when everybody had a pent-up desire to invest in a community. So the amount of redevelopment we had going on was just overwhelming at times. I think right now we've had 6-7 years of significant investment here, and things are slowing down. The costs are going up, and I think the market needs to absorb some of the development that's been going on.
One of the pluses of development, of course, is an increasing tax base. It helps fund infrastructure as well as, you know, just raising property values for residents. But in more recent years, businesses have pushed back getting their taxes increased. Can you talk about what's known as the dark store loophole and how it affects communities like Wauwatosa?
Sure. This is another issue I've been working very hard, going to Madison quite often and testifying. It's really not that the taxes are being raised on these commercial properties as much as their challenges to say they're only worth what it would be if it was vacant. So what it ends up, if we lost every challenge that's going on right now in Wauwatosa, we would lose $43 million in property value. But that doesn't mean our city costs go down. So that ends up spreading that tax burden, shifting it over to smaller businesses and residents, homeowners. And so it's really, now I just got notice today that Governor Evers is going to put a proposal in his budget bill that will close the loopholes for the dark store and for the Walgreens. So we still have, we worked on getting a bill drafted, and it's sponsored by 37 legislators, bipartisan. And so they've all committed to continue to support it.
This seems like an ideal point to welcome another guest to the stage. Stay with us, Mayor Eli. But this gentleman covers real estate and development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Let's welcome Tom Takin. So, Tom, how typical would you say the issues are that Mayor Eli is talking about in terms of what other communities around Milwaukee and Wisconsin are dealing with in general?
Very typical. I mean, most communities in our area, they all have to deal with the same things, especially older communities. Like Wauwatosa, as the mayor pointed out earlier, it's not a bedroom post-World War II community that it established as a bedroom community. It's existed since, you know, 1830. God, that old. I mean, so like Milwaukee and like West Allis and, you know, West Milwaukee, I'm running out of examples here. These are all communities that are older established communities. So as a result, they have older infrastructure, roads, bridges, things like that, sewers, water mains that tend to fall apart earlier. And they also have an economic base that was kind of rooted in the manufacturing industry that had to go through those transitions when manufacturing first shrunk. You know, the big first shock was like 80, 81, and then later in the 90s and continues today. So yeah, the problems aren't that much different. I mean, the biggest difference between a community like Wauwatosa and a community like Milwaukee is Milwaukee, of course, is frankly, that's where all the poor people live in our area. I mean, the poverty rate in Milwaukee is so much higher than it is in other communities, and that's a result of, frankly, racial segregation. I mean, it's really that simple. I don't think I'm telling anybody here. You're NPR listeners. You all know this, right? I don't have to explain this to you, so you know these things.
Well, at the same time that we're sitting here on North Avenue, a lot of Wauwatosa's retail story is one of malls. You know, both the old school contained indoor mall like Mayfair, newer developments like Mayfair Crossing. Why does it seem to be still working here in Tosa, but, say, struggling in other places?
Well, Wauwatosa's kind of lucky. In a way, it's more than luck, but it does have.
You're
the
welcome
luck
to weigh in on that, Mary.
It does have the luck of being sort of centrally located, yes, within the metropolitan area. So if you are Nordstrom and you're looking to build a store in the Milwaukee area, and at the point that Nordstrom came into the Milwaukee area, I think we were the largest metropolitan area in the United States that did not have a Nordstrom. Thank God that crime has been rectified. But when Nordstrom wanted to come in here, they very naturally looked at Mayfair partly because of the central location relative to not just Wauwatosa, of course, but take the communities off the top of your head, Brookfield, Menominee Falls, thank you, Germantown, Waukesha, all within a relatively short distance. They could have gone further west out to Brookfield Square, but that would take them a little bit further away from some of those communities. That's part of it. I think another part of it is that Wauwatosa has done in the last decade or so a good job of encouraging development that has built up its tax base. I'm trying to remember, you were losing residents declining as late as the 2000 census, is that correct?
It's been going up since I've been mayor.
Yeah. but you know, you add apartments, as Wauwatosa has done, you add people, and you add tax base, and you add people who want to shop at stores like Nordstrom, and you always want your population to be increasing. You don't want it declining, generally speaking. By the way, that's why immigration's a good thing. It's a plus for the United States to have more people coming in here rather than leaving. Let's just explain that to people. Very quick explanation.
At the same time, let me jump in, maybe to both of you here. Is there a risk of, you know, living with retail and dying with retail?
That's why we need to make sure. Well, we have the medical complex. And that's what, although people complain about it creating a lot of traffic, it creates a lot of well-paying jobs as well. And so we need to build on that retail, that entertainment area, but also on creating really good jobs.
Has there been pushback against development in places like Wauwatosa, not just in terms of taxes like the dark store loophole, but among residents?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Change is hard.
And let me ask you this, because I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, Mayor. You had the creation of State Street
Crossing.
Station.
State Street Station, thank you. Mm-hmm. You had that. And then you had Harmony Square, both within a few blocks of each other. So mm-hmm. that was like 150 apartments at State Street Station, about another 30 or 40 or so at Harmony. And then when Klein Real Estate Development came in last year, they wanted to do about another 70 or so units, kind of in the same general area of the village area. Mm-hmm. And that didn't go forward. And what was the difference between that and those two other ones as to why that one didn't get public
acceptance? It had more to do, we do a lot of planning in Wauwatosa. We have our bike ped, we have our village plan, our North Avenue plan, our Burleigh Triangle plan. And that really guides us in what we're going to put forth as development and accept. And that particular area was, it's got some traffic challenges that need to be corrected before we take up land that will limit the amount of flexibility we have in redesigning that intersection. Mm-hmm. So that was a major factor. And the neighbors were worried about it as well. But I think it ultimately came down to we didn't want to reduce our options.
Are you hearing more and more from residents who are looking at some of those newer apartment developments, not just in the village area, but out on your west side, for example, the Reserve at Mayfair, the 2100, who are looking at those and saying, are we doing too much? Are we getting too dense? Are we doing too much of this type of housing?
Well, I think that's always a question, and you never know quite when you get to that tipping point. But that's why I think the fact that the There's a bit of a slowdown in development right now, and a lot of that is because the building costs are going up significantly.
Tariffs on aluminum and steel will do that. Yeah.
and yeah. Actually, I think it's...
I think I'm
I'm not
raw
going
materials,
there.
You know, right.
But I actually think this is a good little pause in time to be able to absorb what we have. Mm-hmm. We're finding that the occupancy rates are very high for the apartments, and it does give some people options who don't want to own a home. And sure. I think that's what Wauwatosa is all about. We have a lot of options in our housing and our lifestyle and our housing stock. So I think that's really important.
I'm just going to jump in quickly because we have to wrap up this segment, but I need to put you on the spot for a moment, and everybody loves it when they hear that. Your term is up in 2020. Are you thinking...
That's a year from now.
The math is good. Your future is still as... Are you thinking of running again?
That's a year from
okay.
now.
Fair enough.
In a year, we'll come back.
We'll do this show right back yes, here in a year.
Exactly.
She's the only person in public office who's not declared a candidacy for the Democratic nomination for president. Right here, the only one in America.
Right here.
I swear to God. I mean, the mayor of South Bend, for God's sakes, is right.
It's because I'm not affiliated with a party.
Right.
Well, Kathy Eli, the mayor of Wauwatosa, thank you so much for coming in and joining us here on Lake Effect tonight. And Tom Dakin covers real estate and development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to you as
thank
well.
Thank you.
Great fun. Thank you for being here.
Coming up next on the show, a Wauwatosa cultural institution that many may not be aware of. We'll learn about the Ward Irish Music Archives when our Lake Effect On-Site continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect from East Tosa. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I am Bonnie North. We are coming to you from Birch on North Avenue. Our next guests are based just a few blocks southwest of here on Wauwatosa Avenue. A little different music than what we just heard.
Jeff Kazak is the archivist with the Ward Irish Music Archives. Barry Stapleton is the director. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, this is a really basic question. Yes.
Yes, by all means, applaud.
Yes. A basic question for those who don't know, what are the Ward Irish Music Archives and why are they here in Tosa?
Well, the Ward Irish Music Archives is one of the educational arms out of Milwaukee Irish Fest, which is celebrating 39 years this year. And with all of the, it actually happened in Ireland when Ed Ward was looking for talent in Ireland to play the festival. The Irish Traditional Music Archives in Dublin had just opened up, and Ed thought he'd stop in and see what they were doing. And he was waiting in a little room in a library, and Ed went to pick out a book, and he actually picked out a book that was written by his grandfather. And so that was his inspirational moment, and he came back and asked the board, if they're doing that in Ireland, who's doing that in America? He asked the Board of Irish Fest to support the archives, the Ward Irish Music Archives, and that was the beginning, 1992.
So where did the first items come from?
Well, with the success of the festival in the early years, especially in the 80s, we were growing rapidly, and at that time, it was pre-CDs, so we were getting PR kits from bands, and at one point, we were getting 500 PR kits a year. Just for the success of the festival. So that core collection is still our core collection. It grows every year. Although the difference now, instead of a LP, I get an email from a band saying we're the best Irish band ever. Check out our website. And so now it's more of a digital collection versus the hard copy.
Who are the archives here for? Who uses them?
The archives are kind of here for the public in general that has any kind of interest in Irish or Celtic-related music. So we've had, student groups come in to take a tour to kind of take a look at the material. We also have Irish musicians that will do research. And actually, we have some kind of genealogical ties where people know that their family has Irish musicians or some sort of Irish music tie in their family, and they'll reach out to us, and we'll see how we can help them.
There's also a lot of historical stuff that's come up from Chicago. I know you have wax cylinders, so things that go back 100 years or more.
Yeah, absolutely. We have the Dunn Family Collection, which has within it 32 wax cylinder recordings, recorded by Francis O'Neill of Chicago, who's a brilliant Irish music collector, rose to be captain of the police department down in Chicago in the early 1900s, and they're field recordings of traditional musicians from Chicago. And they came up to an Irish musician that emigrated to Milwaukee in the 1870s named Michael J. Dunn. And he kept that material after some of the musicians in Chicago had passed away. And they stayed in an attic in South Milwaukee for 80 years. And the family found them one day as they're clearing out the house looking for their grandfather's firefighter uniform. Michael J. Dunn was a firefighter on the Milwaukee firefighter force, and brought them to the archives, and the rest is history. We worked with the Library of Congress to digitize those cylinders and then made them available on a website and also a CD project.
So you can hear them if you go to the website.
Yeah.
You can actually hear those.
You can go to wardirishmusicarchives.com and listen to all those cylinders.
Well, and so talk about your work as an archivist. What goes on in a typical day at the archives, and what does your work involve?
Those of us in the archives profession have a favorite phrase, which is, it depends. Depends on the day. But mostly, you know, I've been working on a lot of cataloging, so it's kind of almost a traditional library role, but we also work on digitization projects, digitizing sound recordings and video recordings. We've worked on a couple of major digital collections like the Irish Sheet Music Archives, where we've made public domain sheet music available as well. So it's a lot of working with analog recordings and moving into the digital domain.
So you talk about sheet music. Do you lend things out? Is it kind of like a lending library? Do you require people to come and use it there?
No, we don't lend things out. So basically what we're trying to do, as Jeff mentioned, we're trying to digitize as much as we can so that it's basically a virtual library. So obviously we live within copyright, so we have to live within those laws. But we hope that we can get our materials to students in Ireland that are studying music, Sweden, Africa, Australia, wherever. And so it's more virtual. We do have people come in and do some research, but it's more online that we're trying to get all of our collections onto.
Yeah, you're digitizing most of this stuff, but you know, it sounds like you still have a lot of it in your possession. Museums and institutions much larger than yours have challenges adequately storing and preserving their collection. What are the ways that you address that issue? Like, how do you keep wax cylinders safe, for example?
Right, it's a challenge. So, especially we're in a historic building in Wauwatosa as well, so we kind of double down on our housing and try to get those in protective, archivally safe housing, and store them within temperature and humidity parameters to keep the artifacts safe. And we do the digitization to provide access and ability for people to actually either view or listen to this material, so we don't have to damage the rarer material by repeatedly playing it or making it physically available.
Digitization is basically the best thing you can do for preservation. So that's amazing. And we actually hired two more employees because we got a $50,000 grant from Ireland to digitize the collection. And so that money is all going towards the collections and getting everything online.
Is there a benefit to being in a town like Wauwatosa rather than, say, being in Chicago? I mean, I think a lot of people might think something like this important to the history of both countries, of the Irish here in America, would be somewhere bigger.
I think you're right as far as expectations. We're fine being right where we are. We love Wauwatosa. We're kind of entrenched in the community here with Irish Fest. In Tosa tonight, we have a Irish night there. So our roots are here. And once again, it's more virtual, more digitization that we're dealing with. It wouldn't matter, quite frankly, where you are. Quite frankly, a couple of our major collections are from Chicago because they know that we're dealing with those collections in a professional way versus giving it to another institution where it might just sit in a corner and not be dealt with.
When it comes to collecting the material, are you selective, or, I mean, literally you're saying you get emails from people saying we're the greatest band in the country, download our songs. I mean, is it as simple as that, or is there stuff that you just can't take?
Yeah, there are things you can't take. Like, we try to be selective with our mission and collecting policies. So our mission is really to collect Irish music and Irish music in America. So we have some sort of clear defined parameters. That way it will kind of give us leeway to say yes or no to any given material. And we're kind of collecting material outside of genre. So we're looking at, you know, American popular music that has roots from Irish ancestry.
Like YouTube bootlegs.
YouTube bootlegs. If you have them around, that's great. Thin Lizzy, which a lot of people don't realize is actually an Irish band. Yeah. But also, you know, the traditional musicians, everyone from Michael Coleman up to Dedan and Lunasa, all the current bands.
I think one of the things that I learned in doing a lot of interviews around Irish Fest time is that so much of the music that came here with the Irish immigrants actually went back to Ireland. They had lost it there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So in America, we were the go-to place, and Germany a little bit, with the music industry, the early music industry. Ireland was a very poor country. A lot of rural areas in Ireland didn't even get electricity until the 1950s, 1960s. And then if they got it, they would take it to the barn because the animals were the main source of their income. So there was not much of a music industry in Ireland. And so when the records were made here, then the records were sent back to Ireland in packages. And so one of the issues, Michael Coleman is probably the most prolific fiddler in history. And one of the problems, the good thing and the bad thing with Michael Coleman is that he was great and he recorded a lot of sides. But then when he sent all the records back, everybody said, now all the Irish fiddlers sound like Michael Coleman, because they were listening to his records. Yes, that is true. It's true with many areas of Irish music.
Well, we want to thank you both for stopping by and telling us a little bit about it. The community can come and visit. Is that correct?
Yep, absolutely. We're in the building Mondays through Fridays, normal hours, and if people want to make arrangements or make an appointment to come view or tour the collections, they can give us a call or drop us an email.
Terrific.
Jeff Kazak is the archivist for the Ward Irish Music Archives. Barry Stapleton is the director. The archives are located here in East Tosa on Wauwatosa Avenue. Thanks to both of you again.
Thank you.
Thank you much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Lake Effect, meat. And not just any meat, really cool meat. We're talking heritage breeds and ethical sourcing when we return with more of Lake Effect Onsite on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Onsite continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is raining, snowing, and sleeting outside as we record this, and we have a capacity crowd at Birch on North Avenue in East Tosa. What a great public radio neighborhood. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie Nora. Thank you so much for being here. Well, if your question is, where's the beef, and you don't have access to your own farm, one place you can find ethically sourced and pasture-raised meats is just south of here on State Street.
Kettle Range Meats is technically across the border in Milwaukee, but for our purposes, we have annexed them and given them a meat visa for their many appearances, at least at the Tosa Farmers Market.
Mark Beers is the proprietor, and Nikki Barr works there and also owns a small heritage pork farm. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will discount the irony of looking over their shoulders at the McDonald's behind them. For people who choose to eat meat, why would they choose to pay maybe a little more to shop with you or a butcher shop like yours?
Well, there's a lot of reasons that people would shop at a butcher shop like ours, depending on what their particular interests are. But there's environmental reasons, there's health reasons, and there's social reasons. A lot of people are interested in preserving the beautiful rural economy that we have here in Wisconsin. That's a way to do it. A lot of people are interested in eating healthier, and they're looking for clean local products.
So what was your journey to this work? Why did you decide to become a butcher and specialize in ethically sourced meat?
Well, I'll have to give you a disclaimer first. I'm not actually a butcher.
You're not?
No.
You just
my butchers might be a little bit upset if
okay.
If I
Why did you
that.
Choose to become a proprietor
yes.
of ethically sourced meat?
Yeah. And butchers.
So I spent most of my adult life in Argentina. And you think of three things when you think of Argentina. You think of tango, and you think of inflation, probably, and you think of beef. My partner in Argentina's family was a ranching family, so I got a lot of exposure to the meat industry while I was there. And when I came to Wisconsin, I discovered, much to my surprise, that Wisconsin is one of the best places in the United States to grow beef. People think of dairy here, but there's a tremendous number of farmers that are doing really amazing things, raising beautiful animals and really high quality beef. And I was interested in joining that movement for environmental reasons and, like I said before, for social and health reasons.
Did you not learn to dance?
Oh, I'm not going to do it in front of your audience.
It's radio. No one will see it.
But talk about those environmental reasons. You mentioned the environment a couple of times. Connect the dots for us. How does what you do interact with a positive view of the environment?
Well, farmers that raise the kind of cattle that we process and sell at Kettle Range tend to be concerned about the environment, and they tend to be concerned about the watershed, and they tend to be concerned about the impact that their agricultural activities have on the land. They're very much custodians of the land. There are a lot of agricultural practices that harm the land, but there's a lot of agricultural practices that can actually benefit the land and improve the land and make the environment better for everybody. The kinds of farmers that we tend to work with are very interested in that, and they're working on building their soil, and they're working on building a good equilibrium to balance the wildlife in the area and the environmental needs of the area with their economic activities in the area.
There are also a lot of negative impacts on the animals themselves if they are not raised in an ethical way. Is that something you look for too when you create your farming partnerships?
Absolutely. We have a very closed, very small network of farms that we work with. And we know the farms very well. They've signed off on our standards and our protocols for raising and for how they treat the animals. Kettle Range also actually goes onto the farm. It selects the animals on the farm. It transports the animals. We're involved in every stage of the process. So we're very certain that the animals that we end up processing and that our TOSA neighbors end up eating are treated very well through every step of their lives.
This is the perfect place to bring Nikki in. Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So I raise heritage pork down in Kenosha County. I've been involved in agriculture my entire life. I grew up actually showing pigs. I grew up on a cattle and row crop farm, but I took an interest in showing pigs. So it's something that since I graduated, I've wanted to get back into and found an opportunity to find an outlet, one, as Kettle Range, for selling my pork. And, you know, I've really found here in Wisconsin, I'm originally from Missouri, that there's a lot of support here for sustainable agriculture and doing things kind of the right way and raising pigs outdoors and on pasture and letting them forage. So it's really exciting for me to be here and be a part of it.
Talk a little bit about the heritage breeds. What are they, and were they in danger of disappearing?
They sure were. So when we talk about heritage breeds of pork, we're really talking about the breeds our agrarian ancestors used to raise back before agriculture modernized and kind of moved all animals indoors. Really, when that happened, there were about four or five breeds that were picked by the pork industry. Half of them because they could make a lot of babies, and half of them because they could grow really fast. So about 90% of the pork that's produced in the U.S. commercially is crossbred for efficiency. I think the goal was always to get animals to market in a less amount of time with less inputs. We find that heritage breeds, breeds such as like Cooney Cooney, some Berkshire, Chintasinase, another breed that we source, we really started to see their numbers decline as the pork industry progressed and started choosing for these breeds. Some of these heritage breeds saw numbers in only the 200s in the 80s worldwide. They were almost extinct. And it's important that we keep the genetics of those heritage breeds alive because these are breeds that do really well outdoors. They're very hardy on pasture and things like that. And these are genetic traits that we want to keep around for future agriculture generations. Not only that, but they taste really great.
All right, so that's a great way. Yes. That's a great
that's a
transition
segue.
Here.
Yes.
And let me ask this to both of you because you talk about how there were just a handful of breeds that were really common for a long time and still are really common here. Consumers are used to pork and beef tasting a certain way. when you raise animals this way and we talk about heritage breeds, the meat tastes different. How do you, first of all, how do you get consumers used to the way different kinds of meat taste versus, you know, what they've grown accustomed to across the street at McDonald's?
Well, we've been very lucky because there's a really vibrant food community in Milwaukee, and there's a lot of people that are interested in experiencing these differences and trying new things. So you do have to get people used to sometimes leaner meat, meat that needs to be prepared in a slightly different manner, meat that has more fat or less fat, you know, but that's the role that we play at Kettle Range. You know, one of the things I'm very proud of is that we have an amazingly well-informed and professional staff. And so one of the roles of the community butcher shop is for you to be able to walk in and speak to somebody and get some advice and get some pointers. Maybe you want to make dinner, but you don't know what you want to make. They can suggest a recipe. They can suggest a cut that you're not familiar with, and they can suggest how you prepare it. And so that's precisely the role that we try to fill.
I will say that we don't have a water cooler, but if we did, we wouldn't be talking about what we watched on Netflix or what was streaming. My colleagues and I are like, what we made for dinner over the weekend. And everybody gets really, really excited
about
it.
What was the last thing you made for dinner?
I actually made some pork steaks last week, and they were fantastic. I slow braised them, and they were delicious. So, yeah, it's something that we get really excited about, and we always talk about together and trying different cuts. And cutting things different ways, and then sharing that with our customers. We're all foodies.
I was gonna say, is there one less common cut of meat, pork, beef, whatever, that you would recommend somebody try that we might not know about?
I will. So one of the things that I find is cuts are very regional. Not even just, you know, well, in the United States, but globally, of course. So this is one of my favorite things that we do is people will come in and they're Peruvian and they're looking for something that tastes like home. It's a cut that isn't very popular here because it's not the way that we break animals. You know, it's not what we're used to. So we ask them and we get together and we Google it and our butchers get really excited about cutting them something. And it's more than selling them a piece of meat. It's selling them, a piece of home. We have pork steaks where I come from. Pork steaks aren't really popular in the upper Midwest, I find. But it's one of those foods that when I eat it, it's home to me, you know? So it's something like that.
So you are one person who gets excited about how the sausage is made?
Yes, I do.
And you are another?
Very much so.
All right.
Mark Bierce is the proprietor of Kettle Range Meats. Nikki Barr works there and also owns a small heritage pork farm in Kenosha County. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
We will take one last break, and then Tosa's own Cock Marshall Trio comes out front and center. That's when Lake Effect Onsite continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect Onsite from East Tosa continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are recording live in front of an audience at Birch on North Avenue. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I am Bonnie North. And the Cock Marshall Trio has been playing us on and off all night here at Birch. Greg, it is so great to see you.
Always nice to see you. Here on the home turf.
We are on your home turf. And since the last time you played in the Lake Effect studio, we're trying to figure it out before, I think it's been about a year.
Could be.
You guys were just about to go to
Europe.
Yeah. Yes.
And we should say there's Dylan Cock over there and Toby Lee Marshall on the mighty Hammond B3.
Yes, that is correct.
And so how did that go?
It went fantastic. We go there, we rock, we eat, and we repeat on a daily basis in an exotic port of call. We see something glorious and historic, and then we defile it with the power of our rock music. And yes, then we go to the local eating establishment and eat them out of house and home.
Right.
And repeat.
The power of the gristle.
That is correct.
Yeah. And Toby Lee, you brought one of the smaller Hammond
B3s. This is a small one, right. Yes, this is the chopped down C2, yeah.
Yeah, when for those of you who have not seen a Hammond B3 before, when they brought it into the studio, it was about double that size.
The other one, yes, it has foot pedals attached to the bottom.
So did you say that is a C2, did you say?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yes.
Which is one lower, and, you know, actually, I guess the C is one higher, and the 2 is one lower.
Yeah, it's one lower, one higher. That's exactly right.
So
you didn't know we were playing Scrabble tonight.
Is there a word with X?
Yeah.
So tell me about the B3. I mean, how this has been a staple in rock and gospel and, I mean, blues music for a long time.
It has. It's everywhere you hear music. You know, a lot of people don't realize they know the sound of this instrument until they hear it and they go, oh, I've heard this in, you know, music ever since these things were around.
What makes it different from, say, other organs that are out there, like a Wurlitzer or something else?
Well, there's a lot of things. For me, what makes it different is just the gutty, overdriven tones that I can get out of this thing, as opposed to like a Wurlitzer would be more of a home sort of great instrument where, you know, you'd learn to play nice Christmas songs
But show us a little grid there.
with this one,
grid on demand here.
Grid on demand. So you can
that's pretty good.
You can feel that. It's about as big as it gets. And, you know, with a Hammond organ, you can play two notes and you're just rocking. It's just, you know, that's all you got to do.
People start lighting, you know.
Right.
Whatever.
Well, was there Hammond as played by one iconic musician that really captured you?
There was. It was actually at a baseball game. At a Minnesota Twins baseball game, I was newly a new piano student. And my dad said, hey, you hear that? That's the sound of a Hammond organ.
Back at Metropolitan Stadium?
No, this was the Metrodome, the early days of the Metrodome. But I heard that sound, and my dad said, that's a Hammond organ, and it was a sealed deal from that point forward. So, I knew what I was going to do.
Well, Greg, not to take too much away from you, you're standing with a whole bunch of equipment that bears your name.
Yeah.
Including a brand new guitar.
Yes, this is true. This is a new signature device that came out this past, actually 2 weeks ago we were in California for something called the NAMM Show, which is the National Association of, is it Music Merchants or Music Merchandisers, one of the two. Anyway, it's where everyone goes and shows their new wares, and this came out, and I wanted a slightly larger body guitar, because every time I play guitar, people look at it and say, is that a ukulele you're playing? I mean, what? And I'm like, hey, I'm a man squatch. I'm 6'7", leave me alone. So I wanted just something that was slightly larger body. And you know, I did stuff for Fender for years on end, and I was telling them, like, you know, there's a lot of big fellers that would like a slightly larger body guitar, but they didn't listen to me. And so years later, I found someone who would listen. And so it's just about 2% larger, but it looks more proportionate. And I have these new revolutionary pickups that I developed with a company called Fishman from Boston that I've been working with. And this company, Reverend, is from the Toledo/Detroit area. And we all got together and said, let's make this doggone thing. So we did, and it comes in three magical colors. This one is called Blucifer.
Nice.
Yes.
And then there's the Pow yellow, and then there's Wow red that is home tonight.
Okay.
Sick.
Did you talk them into actually calling this the Man Squatch?
Well, I wanted to call it the Man Caster, but they thought that was a bit much. And Caster is kind of a Fender thing, so we didn't want to get in trouble. So this is just called the Gristle Master, as it were.
I like it. And it matches the amplifier that also bears your name.
Well, what's interesting about this is the Koch brand has been around for quite some time. It's from the Netherlands, and they make really good stuff. And I always knew about them, and it was kind of a mutual thing from afar. But again, I was doing a bunch of stuff for Fender, and I used Fender amps. And then one year when I wasn't doing much for Fender anymore, the guy, Dolph Koch, came over. We were at a Germany somewhere, and he goes, you know, my wife and I are big fans of yours. We got your CDs. That's so funny. I like your amps, too. What if we worked together? Wouldn't that be crazy? So I stood next to one of their stack of amps, and I posted it on the internet, and it, like, you know, all the guitar geeks were like, do you have your own amps? I'm like, yes.
Yes, I do.
So we started talking about a recipe for what would be a cool amp, and I said, you know, no one has done X, Y, and Z. Can you do that? And so they did. So they made an amp to my specifications. I wanted it to be blue. I got a thing for this blue. I don't know what it is. Sonic Blue, as it's called in car lingo. Anyway, so they came out with it, and they said, well, what should we call it? And I said, well, we have the same last name. Let's just call it The Greg. And lo and behold, it has come out.
Rather than The Dolph.
Well, there you go. Dolph, he's already got his... He's already got his thing. So, yeah, so it's a signature amp, signature guitar, and because they basically solve problems. I mean, it's not like, hey, what can I put my name on? I mean, I had things that I wanted to get done from a ergonomic standpoint that I thought made a lot of sense to me, and I knew they would make sense to other people, and so we did it. So it's one of these things where I can go out of the house with a cord, plug straight into the amp, and I don't need any extraneous pedals, because there's a lot of these little foot switches that people will stomp on to get different effects and what have you, and it's a whole... I mean, not that that's a bad thing. That's a lot of fun, too. I do have my own pedal, which we'll get into later. But this amp, if I just want to plug into it, I don't have to do anything else. It sounds magnificent. You put a mic in front of it, and
well, since glorious. You've plugged into it, I think we need to hear some music.
Yeah, we can do that.
So what are you guys going to play for us?
Well, I was thinking about... doing a song from the Toby O'Rives record. We've got this brand new song that we've been doing called The Funky Klaus. Our tour manager from Germany is Klaus, and is he funky? I really don't know if he is, but he is now. Anyway, we're going to do a little bit of that. We'll do a shortened rendition. Slow. Here we go. 3, 4.
The Cock Marshall Trio with what is purportedly the slow version.
The slow
of the
version.
Funky Klaus.
Yeah. This is a mini show, obviously, for you guys here. And thank you so much for being the house band tonight. I mean, it's been fantastic. What do you got coming up? You got albums coming out, shows happening?
Well, we are working on a new record that will be coming out later this year, we hope. I have an acoustic record that's coming out probably sooner than that in the next few months. Our next time in town will actually be on March 15th at Schenck Hall. So that'll be the next time we'll be actually in the area playing.
Besides here.
As you say, you have played all over the world and slept in all kinds of homes around the world. But
yes.
But why do you still call, you could live anywhere. Why do you still call Wauwatosa home?
Because I thrive on negative reinforcement. No, I'm just kidding. You know, it's a beautiful town. I grew up here. It's a good place to raise the kids. It's centrally located. And whenever I fly home and I'm, flying into Mitchell Field and I see the lake and I'm like, I like my town. Is that wrong? Yeah. And I have my favorite eating places. My kids will tell you I'm a creature of habit.
Well, I think that is all the time we have tonight. Unfortunately, you're going to play us out in just a minute, but we want to thank a whole bunch of people. First of all, I'm Bonnie North.
I'm Mitch Tyke. Big thanks to Birch for having us here, along with our engineer, Jason Reavy, and Christine Lamatina from WUWM for helping make this show possible.
Mitch and I produce Lake Effect on-site along with Joy and Audrey Nowakowski and assistant producer Maddie Andre, our digital producer Lauren Sigvason, and our intern Zoe Munson, who is here tonight.
Thank you so much for tuning in today if you're listening on the radio and for being here at Birch tonight. Join us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next, but first, the Cock Marshall Trio will play us out.
Oh.